the atrocity in Buffalo, and Bezos versus the White House. We'll discuss all this and more on this edition of The Editors. I'm Rich Lowry, and I'm joined as always by the Right Honorable Charles C.W. Cook, the Sage of Authenticity Woods, Jim Garrity, and the notorious M.B.D. Michael Brendan Doherty. You are, of course, listening to a Nash Review podcast. Our sponsors this episode are Allegiance Gold Outer and the What Happens Next in 6 Minutes podcast. More about all of them in due course. If for some reason you're not already following us on a streaming service, you can find us everywhere from Spotify to iTunes. And if you like what you hear here, please consider giving us a glowing 5-star review on iTunes. If you don't like what you hear here, please forget I said anything. So before we get into it in earnest, let me say a few words about Allegiance Gold, the official gold IRA of the Editors podcast. Inflation rates are a growing concern, of course, for Americans with retirement accounts. Allegiance Gold can help you protect your IRA 401k with physical gold and silver. They'll also give you $500 of free silver. That's $500 of free silver with a qualified purchase. Call 844-790-9191. That's 844-790-9191, or visit allegiancegold.com/editors, allegiancegold.com/editors. Please check it out. So Jim, just a horrifying story out of Buffalo. I had this 18-year-old disturbed or semi-disturbed kid radicalized on the internet, scoped out this grocery store in Buffalo, travels 200 miles, wearing camo, tactical gear, goes in and shoots and kills 10 people, injures others. Story of heroism, as you get in almost every single one of these cases, attempts to disarm him and stop the attack. The police show up in short order and apparently has a gun to his neck. They talk him out of it and he surrenders. But just another horrifying case. And, you know, you almost, underline almost, become numb to it, because this is a fact pattern we've experienced time and time again in this country. What do you make of it?
You know, we've had mass shootings in this country for a long time. You can pick which one you think started the modern era. Some might say the 1966, University of Texas Tower Sniper. I think a lot of us would think back to Columbine and the degree to which it seemed to set off this pattern, usually of young people, usually young males who are angry at the world for one reason or another. Maybe they feel like they've been picked on. Maybe they feel like they've been ignored, or for whatever reason, their life has not turned out the way they do, you know, they wanted. And almost all, you know, you almost never see a mass shooter who has a lot of friends, who has a supportive family group, who has this, healthy hobbies and normally well-adjusted people. You know, basically these are people who are loners, angry at the world. Very often, if they're school shooters, they have set an interest in the Columbine shooters. And in fact, that's kind of one of the giant red flags. You're supposed to immediately intervene if you see a teenager taking an interest in that. This guy apparently had threatened to shoot up a school. He apparently had been on the radar screen of law enforcement quite a few times. Once again, we have this excruciatingly enraging pattern. We're constantly told, if you see something, say something. Well, people saw something and they said something. And by and large, the police did nothing until it was too late. But now I'd say, you know, accelerating year by year, we've had this trend in which there's this, like, this double horror, this double pain, in which something terrible happens, innocent lives are torn apart, families are never the same. And then idiots on social media will tell you, you, ordinary conservative, this is your fault. You, law-abiding gun owner, this is your fault. This is inevitable, and this eagerness to turn this into a partisan cudgel and to say, well, this particular act of violence is a terrible act of violence with a broad lesson for all of us. And the broad lesson almost always is, and that's why we have to vote for Democrats. It always seems to come that way. Now, obviously, this weekend, there was also another mass shooting, or attempted mass shooting. One casualty happened in a church in California. And it was a Chinese-American immigrant who was targeting a church of Taiwanese Americans. You're not going to hear nearly as much about that one. And obviously, I'm not saying, you know, we shouldn't talk about the Buffalo one. They're both important. They're both significant. But one very clearly fits a narrative that the media loves to propagate, and is, I think, is indisputably a legitimate problem. White nationalism, white supremacy, a desire to, you know, lash out at the world. We'll talk a little bit more of that in a second. But by and large, it always comes down to I am angry at the world. How dare the world not give me what I want? And then it turns into I'm gonna deal with it by either suicide by cop or by lashing out as many people and trying to kill as many people as possible. That's how these angry people find meaning in their lives. It's extraordinarily frustrating, and I can't help but suspect the instant desire to turn this into a partisan food fight is one of the reasons we don't see any applicable solutions taking place.
So MBD, in our next segment, we're going to get into more detail the debate over a so-called great replacement theory, but let's just stick on this phenomenon as a general matter. I think Jim is absolutely right. Columbine just created this kind of predicate, you know, this cultural mold for this kind of act. Now, obviously not a school shooting, and that there is this distinct subset that the Buffalo shooter represents, which is, you know, a big kind of racist manifesto, you know, all over the map, ideologically, but largely racist and inspired by prior attacks, in this case, the Christchurch attack. And there's just this dynamic where these guys write their big manifestos, write their instruction, their how-to manual in great detail. And this was planned and with great care, unfortunately, to pass on to the next semi-deranged, hateful, malicious person who wants to do the same thing.
Yeah. And there's obviously, like, you know, whatever term you want to use it, as far as imitation or mimesis, you know, a lot of this Buffalo shooter's manifesto was just cribbed from the Christchurch shooter in New Zealand. And there's almost like a kind of mass shooter subculture, right? Of, you know, a lot of times these shooters are obsessed with the previous mass shootings and the, you know, seek to draw attention to their ideas through them, or like become almost glamorized through this act of horror and terror. And this was an interesting one in that, like, it kind of brings together a bunch of things that have been bubbling up in our culture and in social problems we've all been talking about obliquely. Like, I mean, the shooter's manifesto basically explains that he was radicalized on 4chan, you know, a message board on the internet, that he dove into this headlong because he was locked down for 2 years of his teenage life. So, like, right there you have a bit of the mental health crisis that teens are facing, the dislocation and destabilization of the pandemic era and our policies during in it. And then the totally disintermediated and, in a way, almost like naturally anti-institutional, anti-establishment, anti-everything nature of the internet, right? That this is, these are ideas passed around as samizdat, right? You know, these aren't, we'll get into the where it connects with mainstream ideas later, but these kind of manifestos or the memes that are shared on many pages of this shooter's manifesto, this is, you know, modern day samizdat. This is the stuff you're supposed to not be talking about. And so it has an allure for young men, and young men who also have a propensity to violence, and many young men who don't have a future otherwise. So it is kind of a collision of a lot of social forces that we don't have a great handle on, and that there aren't ready-made solutions for either.
So Charlie, Jim mentioned, you know, this guy was on the radar screen and the police didn't do anything about him. There was just this evaluation. I don't know, maybe it took a day and a half. The New York Post has an editorial today. Well, damn it, this gun shop owner, he should have known something was wrong with this kid. But it is definitely part of these, in these cases, there's always something, right? No, everyone kind of had an inkling something was off or something was wrong. On the other hand, you know, that there are also a lot of false alarms out there. There are a lot of kids that say things, I'm sure, like this kid did at some point in school. They wanted to commit a murder suicide that sets everyone's hair on fire, and then they don't do anything. And he hasn't committed a crime, and he's not, you know, seriously mentally ill and committable. It raises the question. That's one of the things that makes these cases so hard. What do you do? How do you stop them beforehand?
That's a million-dollar question. I think it's extremely difficult to answer, and I find the people who pretend otherwise irritating and glib. It seems to be the default position of many on the left and within the Democratic Party, and a few on the right too, that we all secretly know how to fix this, but some of us don't want to. And that isn't correct. I don't know how to fix any part of this. There are 400 million privately owned guns in the United States. Pass whatever law you want. That will not change. I don't know how to fix the mental health element, and I don't know how to fix the communication element. And leave guns aside for a moment. What is it that people want to do about this sort of ugly, racist garbage on the internet? Because the only way of effectively superintending it is to gut the First Amendment. Is that the plan? What do people want to do about figures who are presumed to be dangerous but haven't committed a crime? Do we wish to arrest them for pre-crime, for their speech? Do we wish to restrict their constitutional rights because we suspect they might do something? Do we wish to avoid that by placing them under permanent surveillance, following them around? Is that practical? Is that wise? Is that liberal? I don't raise these questions to deflect. I raise them because I think they're key. And because I don't think anyone knows how to solve this particular problem. I think at the margins, we can take actions that might improve things. One of them is to stop glorifying the people who commit these sorts of crimes and making them central to our politics for a month after they do so. But beyond that, I don't know. The question is not whether or not the United States should have 400 million privately owned firearms, but whether it does, and it does. The question is not whether the internet should be full of racist garbage that anyone can access, but whether it is, and it is. And the question is not whether or not individuals under the law should have expansive due process rights, but whether they do. And they do. And I don't believe there's a great appetite to change that. So I don't know. I will once again throw up my hands and say this is no less distressing for those among us who are skeptical that we can fix this with sweeping, occasionally draconian changes, but that I am unwilling to bargain away the Bill of Rights and our constitutional order on some quixotic attempt to solve what is really the hardest problem in criminal law, in that you cannot predict who and when and why this will happen.
Yeah, you literally need to be able to stop a pre-crime.
The point is that if you talk to criminologists about crime in general, we can even restrict it to crime that's committed with firearms. They will tell you that there are certain things that we can do in order to, for example, make certain areas of a city safer. You can post police there.
Right.
You can intervene early. You can work out who is behind the drug trade or who is selling illegal weapons or what went wrong in the communities or the schools or what you will that are feeding gang life. You just can't do it with this. It's just so hard. The guy went 200 miles. What are you going to do about that bit? And I throw my hands up in despair and sadness and say, I think this is a national tragedy that is really, really difficult to get a hand on.
Yeah, so apparently the key indicator of whether you will be a victim of a shooting in an urban, you know, gang environment is whether you're present at a prior shooting, if you're just somewhere in the vicinity. And actually, you know, there has been some success that authorities have had. Just if you know who the gang members are, intervening with them, with people who have credibility, former gang members. But anyway, this is a harder problem. And Jim, just immediately, Charlie and I were talking about this offline yesterday. The two main solutions that were advocated for dealing with this problem directly implicate the first two items in the Bill of Rights. One, we're going to eliminate hate speech on the internet. No, you're not. And two, we're going to have gun control that's going to take care of this. And of course, any gun control measure that would possibly be sweeping enough to stop someone like this from buying a gun is going to run into Second Amendment problems. I keep coming back to, and this is not, you know, obviously not a ready solution, but one, no matter how, whatever the warning signs that others could see or that we can see in retrospect, the direct family members must have had even more reasons to be concerned about the mental state of this kid. And I think it's really hard for parents. You know, they don't want to stigmatize their children. They don't want to believe the worst. But if you just have any inkling someone around you might be capable of such a thing, you got to be taking it as seriously as possible. And two, I think, and again, this is not a magic bullet, I would support some sort of information campaign that finds one of these guys who's committed this an act like this, who regrets it, is willing to play ball, and have him in an orange jumpsuit and you know, testifying to the camera. This is why I did this. This is why I got caught up in this perverse, cloistered world of hate and evil, and I regret it every single day of my life. And try to get that message out and maybe push, you know, some kids who are on the fence in the direction away from this. But that's not an easy answer. None of it's there is no easy answer.
No, and I think what we see in these circumstances is a seemingly relentless appetite towards blame shifting. In many of these cases, the gunman gets killed in the, you know, at the end of the mass shooting. Or, you know, we can see this person being put behind bars, but it doesn't feel like enough, right? They go, well, there's got to be somebody else we can blame. There's got to be somebody else whose fault it is, even though the gunman was the only one who pulled the trigger. And so I'm old enough to remember when Dungeons and Dragons was the terrible Satanist threat that was going to turn your kid into some horrible human sacrifice practicing maniac. You know, obviously, before that, heavy metal music. If you played it backwards, you could hear Satan's messages and stuff like that. And obviously, for the last, I'd say, you know, 30 years or so, you've seen this accelerating argument of either violent video games or the internet. Now, obviously, if every person who played Grand Theft Auto turned into a carjacker, we'd have nothing but carjackers going on all day long. It's not a matter of any one of these things turns a person into a violent criminal. I think there was some person on the internet, on Twitter yesterday, who was insisting that if your son plays video games, chances are someone in the white nationalist community has tried to recruit them. You know, and I, you know, said to my older son, hey, anybody try to recruit you into a violent nationalist gang? No, Dad. All right, remember what Nancy Reagan said? Just say no. Yeah. There is kind of this infantilizing mentality of taking young people and believing that if they come near this bad influence, all of a sudden, presto changeo, they're going to turn into some terrible mass shooter. Even though, as we see in each one of these cases, there are red flags and red flags that build steadily over time. And it's not merely a matter of, are they playing this video game or are they hanging out on this chat board or something like that. Now, should parents be watching what their kids are interacting with and stuff like that? Sure. But there's this absolute desire to say, well, being angry at the gunman isn't enough. So we have to get mad at video games or the internet or chat boards or Tucker Carlson or some other, you know, you only got to find some other, the NRA, it's Wayne LaPierre's fault, you know, this endless desire to find someone else to blame that, oh, by the way, conveniently lines up with our previously existing political opponents.
So MBD, exit question to you. Do you have any confidence that this horrific, gut-wrenching trend of mass shootings will abate anytime soon?
No. I mean, we've been asking this question. You know, I remember a version of this during after the Las Vegas shooting, which is also still mysterious, or after the Waukesha car attack. I don't see an end to this. And what's frightening is, you know, one thing I wanted to mention was a lot of these mass shooters, they're identified. They're identified by school psychologists, by local law enforcement. They're often identified years in advance as a potential danger. But of course, like, it's not just them that are identified, but like, you know, almost like 1 out of 100 boys now is classified as having developmental disorders or autism of some kind, or needs to be drugged to get through public school. So there's some mysterious kind of social script at work, some kind of extremely ugly dance between the psychology of these young men and even the people trying to help them and identify them. And then they themselves begin to recruit themselves into this story of, like, my story ends as a mass killer. And yeah, I don't know how to interrupt that. It's very dark, and I don't know if the answer is psychological, religious, familial, cultural. I mean, it's probably all of the above.
Charlie?
No, I don't.
Security.
No, and if we really were worried about teens spending a lot of time online, being isolated, becoming angry loners, etc., well, we probably should have thought about that a little harder and a little stronger before we shut down schools for a year.
Yeah, unfortunately, the answer is no. With that, let's hear from our second sponsor this episode, Outer. 93% of your life is spent indoors, but so many of our favorite moments are outdoors. The fresh air, the feeling of peace. Since warmer weather is here, let's make the most of it with Outer, the new outdoor furniture company with purposely designed furniture to get you outdoors more. Outer makes the world's most beautiful, comfortable, innovative, and high-quality outdoor furniture, all from sustainable materials, and is the only outdoor furniture with a patented built-in cover to make protecting it effortless. From teak chairs to fire pit tables, everything Outer makes has the look and feel of what you would expect at a five-star resort for less than you'd pay at a big box store for something that won't last. Outer's better in every way because they've spent years perfecting outdoor products with stunning modular designs to customize your space. Life-proof material with nano coating that's water, mold, bleach, and stain resistant. Over 1,000 neighborhood showrooms across the country to see the Outer difference in person. And triple memory foam cushions that are comfier than most indoor sofas. Outer's patented built-in outer shell cover protects your furniture from rain and dew. It's the how did no one think of this before invention that made Shark Tank's Lori Grenier and Mr. Wonderful fight to invest in Outer. I actually love working outdoors. The outdoor furniture we inherited when we acquired our house is disgusting. Just before recording this podcast, I was sitting out in the driveway and not in one of those chairs, but actually in a tiny green toy chair because the outdoor furniture we have is so disgusting, which means I need to get Outer myself. If you look at their website, it's just beautiful looking furniture, and I urge all of you to check it out. In addition, Outer Furniture comes with best-in-class warranties like 10 years for their aluminum line and a 2-week trial with free returns. See the difference at liveouter.com/editors. Plus, for a limited time, get $300 off and free shipping. This is Outer's best offer anywhere, only available to listeners of our podcast and only for a limited time. Get $300 off and free shipping at liveouter.com/editors, liveouter.com/editors. Terms and conditions apply. Please check it out. So MBD, a big part of this debate post-Buffalo shooting is about great replacement theory, conspiracy theory that has figured in prior mass shootings, that was part of the manifesto that holds there's a secretive cabal of Jews who who are conspiring to admit non-whites into the United States in order to perpetrate a genocide on the white race and wipe it out. This is obviously a poisonous and false theory, but the left and the media is not being particularly careful about this. They're accusing all sorts of other folks who are just saying, hey, look, Democrats know that or believe that they can disproportionately win over new immigrants, and that plays into their support for higher levels of immigration and for not having strict border controls. They're making that into the equivalent of great replacement theory and arguing that the likes of Elise Stefanik, New York congresswoman who had a Facebook ad along these lines, and Tucker Carlson, who's talked a lot about it, are morally culpable for what happened in Buffalo.
Yeah, so that's wrong to say that about Elise Stefanik and Tucker Carlson. It's wrong because the shooter told us as much, right? He told us exactly where he got his ideas. He got them online. If you find a copy of his manifesto, he includes memes in it that, you know, label Fox News as a den of Jewish conspiracy. I think he even puts one of the images even puts a red Star of David on Rupert Murdoch, who's not Jewish. So this is not attributable to them. That's separate from whether Tucker or Elise Stefanik have always spoken, carefully or guardedly, but nothing either of them have ever said really lends credibility to this maniac's theory. And I think you have to separate out, you know, the great replacement theory as these conspiracy theorists are casting it versus demographic change, which is just a reality of life in 2022, and which is the product of policy decisions, right? So the great replacement theory, at least in America, which I think is different from, it kind of has roots, that phrase in French far-right politics, and it means something a little different there. But over here, it's kind of this thing that there's a deliberate conscious conspiracy to demoralize the white race and to make the way for progressivism by allowing mass immigration, or lots of illegal immigration, by having affirmative action policies that give legal preferments to non-whites in certain legal situations or in job admission, hiring or in college admissions. The fact is there is no conspiracy demoralizing whites, right? Like the American fertility rate is below replacement level. It affects all races of Americans. It particularly affects African Americans and has prevented them from taking a much larger demographic slice of American life than they otherwise would have had the last 50 or 60 years. And if you have a below replacement level fertility rate natively, and you have immigrants who come in, that means you're going to have a demographic shift very quickly. And those things are ambiguous too, because sometimes the people that come in may not identify as white when they come in, but they may identify as white later, or their kids might identify as white. So that's all an uncertainty. But what you find is, I think a lot of progressives have they've had what Charlie's called a Schrodinger's demographic change, right? It's evil when conservatives notice it, but it's good when progressives celebrate it. A lot of them want to conflate the kind of conspiracy version of the theory with conservatives just talking about it or talking about the policies that influence demographic change. And the fact is, you can't actually suppress talk about it because it's going to become a central part of our politics. It's a central part of European politics now to talk about demographic change because we are rapidly heading towards, like, where Japan is, where you're heading towards population decline. And I personally am obsessed with the topic because I think that societies don't work correctly without a posterity in a position to receive the inheritance of that civilization. So yeah, we're going to get more of this, and there's going to be this conspiratorial edge, but no one should allow themselves to be cowed into not talking about it. I mean, in a lot of American history is the talk of, mm-hmm. like, is a kind of replacement theory. Like, my favorite example is to think of Boston, as Boston was a Protestant city. It was a Protestant city almost on par with Geneva and London in its intellectual importance, as a seat of Ulster Scots and Scots-Irish settling in America in the colonial period, as a seat of kind of Unitarian theological innovation in the Brook Farm movement, etc. And then that population was replaced by Irish Catholics emigrating from Ireland, to the point where Irish Catholics became identified so thoroughly with the city that we still call the basketball team the Celtics and give them a shamrock. And so that, you know, they were replaced, you know, or overwhelmed by demographic change. And that had political implications. And, you know, it's fine to discuss them.
So, Charlie, you've written powerfully about this. Just it's foreboding if you oppose immigration because you fear the political consequences. You can't do that. Can't say that. But if you support it, you can. And I had an example of this yesterday. Greg Sargent, left wing, very active writer at the Washington Post, had this piece attacking Elise Stefanik for saying, you know, Democrats want an amnesty because they want a permanent election insurrection, you know, change the electorate forever. You know, put in pretty crude terms as you would expect in a Facebook ad. And I was like, there's no way that Greg Sargent has not at some point said that immigration is this huge benefit to Democrats because it's changing the electorate. And it took me a while to find it, but sure enough, right after the 2012 election, he wrote, this election was all about demographics, and the older, whiter, more male electorate was, he didn't use the word replaced exactly, but that's basically what he said has been changed or shouldered aside by this wonderful new electorate that turned out for Barack Obama. And I tweeted at him, wait a minute, so what's the difference here? And he wouldn't acknowledge it. And all these other lefty writers came in and said, you know, I was guilty of misdirection and it was totally not the same because Elise Stefanik was advancing a conspiracy theory where Greg Sargent was just engaged in election analysis. But it's a classic case where he could say the electorate is changing because of immigration and is great. And Elise Stefanik can't say, well, this is a motivation of Democrats and I oppose it.
Well, I have two objections to this. Before I get to them, I'll reiterate what I said on this podcast when we talked about the subway shooter in New York. And that is that I believe strongly that the illness comes first and then the ideology follows. I think there are people out there who are looking for something in their lives and who find it in the form of extremist ideology or rhetoric that they typically uncover on the internet, whether that's the Nation of Islam or white supremacy or Al-Qaeda. And I think we ought to be careful not to believe that there are all sorts of normal, well-adjusted, happy Americans out there who, if they just come across the wrong idea, will turn into frothing killers. I don't think that's true. It doesn't really help us solve the problem, but it certainly helps us avoid pointing fingers at our fellow citizens and trying to draw absurd, broad conclusions from the terrible and murderous behavior of a tiny number of people, a tiny number of people who can inflict a great deal of harm, but are tiny in number nevertheless. Now, that notwithstanding, I think that this is really a disgusting abuse of what happened in Buffalo. I think that the headlines I've seen, the New York Times editorial board put out a missive titled, "The Buffalo Shooting Was Not a Random Act of Violence," subheading, "The Buffalo Killings Are an Extreme Expression of a Worldview That Has Become Increasingly Central to the Identity of the Republican Party." Rolling Stone had a piece arguing the same thing, that this wasn't a lone wolf. This was a wolf that was shepherded and aided and encouraged by one of the two major political parties in the United States. This is not true. I agree with Damon Linker, I think wrote it the week when Michael was there, who said that the great replacement theory, so-called, is commonly advanced on the left. Now, there are, of course, two great replacement theories. One is the narrow, sinister, anti-Semitic outre idea that is peddled at the margins and the fringes and that was believed and acted upon by the shooter in Buffalo. This theory holds that Jews, even though they're not anywhere close to being a majority, are somehow orchestrating the replacement of white people with non-white people for nefarious ends. And then there is the much more mainstream argument over immigration levels and their political consequences. The problem we have here is that for political reasons, there are a good number of people, especially in the press, who wish to conflate these, or who wish to mix and match them, such that when Republicans engage with demographic change, they are guilty of indulging the nefarious version, but that when Democrats engage with democratic change, they are guilty of nothing more than observing a morally neutral phenomenon. And I'm afraid you just can't have it both ways. The truth is that at the fringes, there are crazy people out there who believe terrible things and they should be condemned. But the rest of this is a normal, historically mainstream debate over politics. In 1784, in Notes on the State of Virginia, Thomas Jefferson worries aloud about immigration. He says, "We've just set up this country. We hadn't got to the Constitution yet, but the war had just been won. And we are fortunate to have had this political inheritance that puts most former colonists, new Americans, at the point of temperate liberty. And if we invite all sorts of people from around the world in, people who come from and are used to and even favor monarchies, we will ruin that." Well, of course, 16 years later, when he's running for president, Thomas Jefferson has completely the opposite view. Why? Because he thinks he and his party would benefit from having people come in and stick it to the Federalists. Alexander Hamilton had certain views on immigration that were directly linked to his views on politics and the likelihood of certain political outcomes depending on the demographic makeup of the country and his, frankly, preference for British stock over the French or Germans or what you will. The point I'm making here is that the debate in which most people what the editorial board of the New York Times calls the identity of the Republican Party. Those people are having is akin to the debate that has raged in America. Sometimes it was ugly, sure, throughout its history. That debate is one in which political parties tend to take rational positions based on what they perceive to be in their self-interest. So Julian Castro, who ran for president under the Democratic banner, has served in Democratic administrations, was a hot young thing for a while in the Democratic Party, has said this openly. Don't worry, before long, the Hispanic vote will increase and Democrats will win in Texas and Georgia and Florida. And we seem to have constructed some sort of set of societal rules whereby his saying that is fine, but people who don't like him saying that aren't. So that if you run around the country saying, soon, we being the Democratic Party will win, then you're right. But if you say, I don't think that's what I want for the future, and I think Republicans should stop it, then you're guilty of some sort of white supremacist conspiracy theory. That is unacceptable. That dog won't hunt. We cannot have a situation in which one side can openly laud and recommend and work to achieve demographic change that it believes is in its political self-interest, and the other side, having noticed, has to shut up. And we cannot have a situation in which when Julian Castro says it, that's the mainstream version, but when others notice what Julian Castro is saying and how he votes on immigration questions, that they are akin to a mass murderer in Buffalo. We have to separate these things out. If we are going to have a conversation about demographics, then both sides have to be allowed to have it without being compared to the fringe version that no one outside of a handful of Americans believes in. And I find this annoying, but funnily enough, I don't have a dog in the fight, in that I find this whole argument over demographics grotesque and somewhat irrelevant. I hate the racial determinism of it. I think it strips agency away from people who aren't white and treats them as an unthinking block of automatons. I think that it is overly simplistic in that it fails to distinguish between different sorts of non-white people. Immigrants into California, very different than immigrants into Southern Florida. And I also think that it's probably wrong. I understand that for a while it looked as if the Democratic Party was going to benefit from this emerging majority, the coalition of the ascendant. Does it look like that now? Is that the lesson from the 2020 election? Is that what we're seeing in Florida and Texas? Is that what we're seeing in opinion polling, especially of Hispanic voters, but also of Asian voters? I don't think it is.
Yeah.
So I don't like this, but I do think people ought to be permitted to argue about it without being compared only on one side to the very worst actors in our society.
Well, and isn't some of the panic that we're seeing in the media about this, sort of the generated panic, isn't it partly reflects a panic that the 2020 election showed racial depolarization of the electorate, where an increasing number of Hispanics were voting for the Republican Party, an increased number of Black men started voting for the Republican Party. And that was a reverse of a trend going back to 2004 of more and more racial polarization.
Right? Yeah, it's one reason that if you want to find the starkest examples of Democrats making this argument, you know, openly and utterly blatantly, It's 08, it's 12, it's in there, because 16 and especially 20 kind of complicated that narrative. But Jim Garrity, it's not news that the press is obsessed with Tucker Carlson. A couple weeks ago, we had this massive three-part New York Times series devoted to Tucker and his upbringing and his family dynamic and just on and on. It's kind of treatment, you know, a nominee of a major political party for president gets. And almost every other story about Buffalo has mentioned Tucker Carlson. There are ways in which Tucker's talked about immigration that I wouldn't, but there's no way that any sane person would listen to Tucker Carlson and say, oh, I have to go shoot up a bunch of black people at a grocery store. It's just that idea is completely bonkers. He goes out of his way when discussing race to say that everyone should be treated the same. But it's just extraordinary that one side of the political debate is taking this as an opportunity to try to shut up one political commentator in particular.
Rich, I'm assuming the coverage I have seen is correct. The shooter in Buffalo laid out in his manifesto at some length how he became radicalized on the site 4chan, or at least in his own self-assessment, correct? And keep in mind, we're talking about a crazy person. Did he mention Tucker Carlson at all?
No.
All right, so he doesn't mention Tucker Carlson, but everybody's pointing the finger at Tucker Carlson.
He's anti-Fox. And it's not even, you know, what you're getting at here, obviously, it's not even like some of these manifestos have, I think like one mentioned Mark Stein once, you know, and obviously nothing Mark Stein had ever done or said would have justified anyone committing mass murder, but a manifesto mentioned him. This doesn't even mention Tucker Carlson is anti-Fox and in some respects, anti-conservative.
I think at minimum, I've always been very wary of anybody in politics who runs around and, you know, explicitly or implicitly is sounding like the closing scene of Cabaret singing Tomorrow Belongs to Me. I know demographics are destiny and all that stuff, but in the end,
people, they're not.
People are
we've learned, right?
Yeah, people are, you know.
Well,
okay, I get the sorry. I heard that sigh, Michael.
Well, I mean, it's just sometimes, I mean, sometimes they are, sometimes they're not, right? Like, I mean, in the example I gave about Boston, which saw the rise of the know-nothings to oppose Irish immigration, right? Like, there was a liberal side that was anti-Catholic, a liberal movement, liberal leagues, etc. And then there was, like, a conservative Protestant side. And the fact is, like, the Irish immigrants were unpredictable. They were, in some ways, more conservative than the conservative Protestants who opposed them and more liberal than the liberals who opposed them. So, like, it's unpredictable. But there are other places where, like in Northern Ireland, same conflict, Protestants and Catholics. Like, Catholics are on track to overtake them, and that will have an effect on the United Kingdom and the Republic of Ireland permanently.
And peoples do get, you know, political set and political cultures. Like, it's going to be really hard for Republicans to win African Americans anytime soon, just because it's such an embedded relationship with the Democratic Party. Now, that obviously has nothing to do with immigration, and that's another perverse aspect of this attack. This maniac and murderer went after old stock Americans. I mean,
I was going to say, I was trying to jump in here and point out the irony that this guy who decides he's worried about replacement theory goes after African-Americans, which as a percentage of the population have shrunk from 13% in 2010 to 12.4% in 2020. African-Americans are one of the groups that are, if you buy into this notion of a replacement theory, one of the groups getting replaced.
Yep.
But I just, in the end, this cultivates this mentality. Like, we on the right have always had this argument of, like, you know, people are individuals. And, oh, by the way, the recent history of our politics, going back to our further interest of politics, is that when the guy in charge does a lousy job, you're going to get voted out of office, regardless of partisan affiliation, regardless of the demographics of the people. If you screw up badly enough, people will throw you out of office, even if they traditionally like the party you're voting for. You know, that's how Republicans ended up winning Anthony Weiner's seat for a cycle. Mm-hmm. That's how Republicans ended up winning a seat in Hawaii for a cycle. Yeah, in terms of, you know, which party wins, which group votes for which party, as we're seeing this ground shifting underneath our feet. So it's always been this, you know, this locked in idea that if somebody has this much melanin in their skin, we know which party they're going to vote for the rest of their lives. But it never works that way. Oh, by the way, people move around, so the demographics of this state or that county or this district end up changing. That's even getting aside from redrawing the House districts every 10 years. So it's always been this, like, utterly infuriating process here. This idea that, well, if we have to pay attention to this, because the coalition of the ascendant that the Democrats kept walking around, patting themselves on the back for, turned on him pretty fast. And it's so I can hear Michael sighing over there. So I'll let him.
No, I'm not sighing. I basically agree that like there is an unpredictability. There's an unpredictable element too, right? So even the like examples I give where demographics are going to have a profound effect, it's usually not even the one predicted, right? Like, I mean, if the, you know, in Ireland, if the six counties are incorporated into the Republic, they're not going to be incorporated into a priest-ridden government ruled by proxy from the Vatican, which is what they feared 100 years ago. And similarly, like fears conservatives stated about immigration in the last 40 or 50 years are turning out to not be true. Some of our hopes are turning out not to be true.
A little bit on that, because all things considered, if you're a Democratic strategist, you'd rather have an electorate that has more poor recent immigrants from Honduras who are poorly assimilated, maybe don't know English, than an electorate, say, you know, of fifth generation Mexican Americans, right? And Republicans are going to tend to do better with that older family than with these new immigrants who eventually may become Republicans, but the odds are they're going to be heavily Democratic at the outset.
Yeah, there are odds for that, but I mean, but then there are exceptions, right? Because sometimes you'll design a policy to let a certain region of the world immigrate more to America, and then their local reaction to conditions on the ground in America is not what you think they would be. So mm-hmm. like, you know, Italian Americans tended to be much more Republican, partly because they were excluded from public institutions by my great grandparents. And, mm-hmm. You know, so you don't, it is, there is some predictability to it. You can see some foresight as the demographics change in a given congressional district or an area, but these generational shifts happen faster than people realize, right? They can happen in 10 years or 20 years. And I think we are witnessing one now. Like we are witnessing, I would bet that the Democratic Party will be whiter in the next election than it was in the last one. Mm-hmm. And I bet that trend continues for a little bit, partly because it's appealing so much to an educated class that is overwhelmingly white. And so that trend, I think, is going to continue, and you're going to see Republicans pick up more voters among racial minorities.
So Chuck Cook, X question to you. Joe Biden and the Democrats will have some success identifying Republicans with the hateful ideology that partly motivated the attack in Buffalo, yes or no?
Yes, some success, but I'm not sure it will do much to save them in the midterms, because I think it will be low down the list of priorities that people vote on.
Jim Garrity.
Yeah, modest success helped along by idiot candidates who will say something stupid at some point.
NBD.
Almost no success. Americans are becoming inured to these insane tragedies, which is itself a tragedy, and they're becoming almost meaningless. They have less and less impact every time. And I think we're headed for an election where Republicans are both going to win a majority of the voters, and they're going to increase their share of racial minorities, which is just going to induce a narrative crisis on it's the end of that era of the coalition of the ascendant talk that, you know, really blossomed 10 years ago.
Yeah, I think they'll have some success. In no way a transformative success, won't affect the midterms materially. And really, anyway, and it would have been easier for Biden to make this argument a couple decades ago, one when the Democrats had more of a grip on the information environment. There's been a proliferation of conservative sources of news and information, obviously, and there's also just kind of a fearlessness now on the right. It might have had more success kind of muting people in the past, but it's not going to happen now. With that, let's hear from our third sponsor this episode. Join hedge fund manager Larry Bernstein for his podcast, What Happens Next? In 6 minutes. The format gives the guest speaker just 6 minutes to present his argument, followed by a provocative question and answer period for deeper engagement. Check out the What Happens Next in 6 minutes podcast with Matt Continetti on a history of the American right and why there's never been a consensus among conservatives. Aaron Friedberg on how we screwed things up with China. Mitchell Schwarzer on the backlash to gentrification, why that causes housing to be unaffordable in California. And Tom Sankton on the challenges in obtaining a ransom for a business executive after a kidnapping. What happens next? In 6 minutes, is fast-paced, intense, and thought-provoking. Bring your A-game because What Happens Next will challenge you. New episodes are posted every weekend. What Happens Next in 6 minutes can be found on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. Subscribe and give the show a listen. Again, What Happens Next in 6 minutes. So, Jim Garrity, we have had a Twitter back and forth between Jeff Bezos and the White House. Jeff Bezos apparently feels a little bit liberated now that he is not the CEO of Amazon anymore. The White House had a typically idiotic tweet about inflation, saying that we could take care of inflation if just corporations were paying their fair share. And Bezos is like, no, that's not how any of this works. White House came back with something else that Bezos was like, look at the squirrel. This is a total misdirection. And they're failing to grapple with this problem. What do you make of it?
So it's intriguing because I think you'd safely say that if we polled our listeners or readers or just conservatives in general, Jeff Bezos would probably not rank among their favorite people. They may enjoy Amazon and its products, but they've had their suspicions that Amazon takes off certain conservative products or books or suppresses them or stuff like that. Or what's more, you know, Bezos owns the Washington Post, and most conservatives think of the Washington Post as a liberal newspaper. So it's kind of intriguing to see the president puts out this statement and Bezos just comes out and says, no, it's not true. And in fact, it's kind of ridiculous. And so the Biden White House, with, I think, some really ham-fisted and clumsy instincts, just kind of, you know, decides to demonize Jeff Bezos. You know, it doesn't require a huge leap to figure out why the wealthiest individual opposes an economic agenda for the middle class. Now, here's the thing. Jeff Bezos is usually a pretty big, you know, is by no means an enemy of the Democratic Party, right? Yeah, and then it's also unsurprising this tweet comes after the president of the labor organizers, including Amazon employee, you know, this all, we're going to cast Bezos as, you know, this enemy, as this, you know, horrible figure. It was interesting. And I think Bezos is, you know, it was from where I sit, Bezos is winning this by a wide margin, making the argument point, like, no, it's not an issue of, you know, the tax rates are too low, which is why, you know, inflation is out of control. But, you know, hey, what do I know? Because Jack Schaefer over at Politico says why Jeff Bezos anti-Biden tweets are so dumb.
So MBD, are you, does this make you feel warmer towards Bezos, or you're like, okay, this is a typical billionaire who's free market oriented on economics, but caters to the woke crowd on anything touching on the culture?
I think to describe my view of Bezos, it's a little different. It's like Bezos is, you know, what maybe Virginia Postrel would have called a dynamist. He believes in excellence and in prosperity. And so, like, oh, you know, he's been described as libertarian, but he's given a lot of money to Democrats. He supported gay marriage. But, you know, I basically would look at Bezos and be like, this is a guy who believes in excellence, in getting ahead, in getting to the future, and any other political value like equality or liberty or not genociding the Uyghurs that gets in the way of getting to the future, I mean, he doesn't care about fundamentally. So, like, you know, his politics would only align with my own by accident. And, you know, he just doesn't like the current Democrats because things are going crappy in America and he wants things to be excellent. And and growing. Growth is good, but I don't trust him as a, I don't think of his principles as all that sophisticated or admirable, no matter how successful he's been.
So Charlie, also Elon Musk was at some event, I think he's part of a panel, and was mocking Biden, so saying Biden is not in control, it's the teleprompter that's in control, and the most powerful person in America at any given moment is whoever gets access to that teleprompter. Can we put Bezos and Musk together and say this is just a, another sign of how just out of control this administration is and events are, that you have even these guys joining into the political pylon, or would that be overinterpreting?
No, I don't think that's overinterpreting. I think Biden has become a national joke, and that there's no way back for him from that, such that these figures feel comfortable joining in,
yeah,
but also are aware that everyone in the audience will get the line. Right. I think that there is another reason that such people have started speaking out, and that is that there is presumably only so much economic illiteracy and political non sequitur issuing that they can stomach. Whatever one thinks of the politics of an Elon Musk or Jeff Bezos or anyone else, they understand how markets work. They can be ruthless in trying to bend those markets and the regulators who superintend them to their will, but they understand how markets work. And the White House is at the moment vacillating between lying and talking nonsense. It lies about inflation and about the causes of inflation, and it talks nonsense in putting together ideas that aren't related, or in some cases are diametrically opposed. For example, Joe Biden tweeted a couple of days ago that if we want to bring down inflation, we need to ensure that the rich pay their fair share. It's just, may as well cut up different slogans, throw them up in the air, and then get a child to paste them onto the wall. We saw that these two ideas are unrelated and that conflating them is indefensible at yesterday's White House press conference, at which the hapless new press secretary was asked by Peter Doocy over and over again, what did the president mean by that? And she couldn't answer, and she can't answer because there is no link. And I think Bezos is looking at the market and the economy, and I think he is growing tired of this. Walmart just posted their worst ever retail report, not because they weren't continuing to sell huge numbers of goods, but because the inflationary environment has made it extremely difficult for Walmart to make a profit, because they operate on narrow margins and make it up at scale. But you can't do that in an inflationary environment. I don't know what Amazon's reports are saying, but I suspect there are similar pressures that Bezos has noticed. So I wonder whether they have just had enough of this and are determined in a judicious way to use their influence to push back, set an example for others, and make it clear that while it is entirely reasonable to have differences of opinion in this country, the finger in the ears, la 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 approach of Biden toward this massive economic problem is insufficient.
Jim Garrity asks a question to you. Yet another yes or no. Joe Biden has hit political bottom. Yes or no?
No. We're going to have a long, hot summer of miserably high gas prices. Today's Morning Jolt is just about how the diesel price is now getting truckers shutting down, saying we're not going to transport that good because it's too expensive to take, including infant formula. Oh, you may remember that one. Energy prices are going to go up higher. Electricity, you're going to have rolling blackouts. You know, everything's going to get worse between now and November. So no, he has not hit bottom.
MBD?
No, he's not hit bottom. I agree with Jim. He's right on the reasons.
Joey Cook?
I agree with Jim too.
I'll make it unanimous. I asked a version of this question a couple months ago, and it was, will he dip below 40% in the polling averages. I said, yes, he's not there yet. Real clear. And 538, he's at 41 point something. So I think it's still plausible he gets below 40. There's still some room for him to fall here. With that, let me do a quick plug for NR Plus digital subscription service at nationalreview.com. We just had a great subscription drive going that juiced our numbers really nicely. Anyone who subscribed over the last week, thank you. Thank you. We really appreciate it. If you haven't subscribed, not too late to get in on NR Plus, your way around our extensive, increasingly extensive and hardened metered paywall. Your way, if you sign up and log in, to see 90% fewer ads and basically none of the obnoxious ads that drive you crazy when you're trying to read our content. Your way to dive deeper into our community. You can comment on blog posts and articles if you're a member of NR Plus and logged in. You can be part of our private Facebook group. You can be invited to exclusive conversations and events with our writers, editors, and conservative newsmakers. So great deal all around. If you haven't already signed up, please do. So let's hit a few other things before we go. Jim Garrity, you've been watching Apollo 10 and a half.
Yes, and no, this is not some secret sci-fi conspiracy or something like that. It's on Netflix by Richard Linklater, kind of known for these quirky independent films. And this is like the most nostalgic, heartwarming film. I point out that it's animated, but it's a very interesting and kind of quirky animation style. It almost looks like they filmed it with real actors and then kind of painted over it. I'd say about one half of this to two thirds of this movie is just what it was like growing up in the Houston suburbs in 1969 with the excitement of the moon landing. And about one third of the movie is this imaginary fable in which NASA has built a moon lander just a little too small for a full-sized man and has to find some 10 and a half year old boy to operate the moon lander in a dry run for the subsequent one in July. It is funny. It is charming. If you were alive during that time period, as I was not, you'll probably be full of nostalgia. But even if you grew up in the 70s and 80s, you'll see a lot of stuff that you recognize. It is heartwarming and sweet and also big for anybody who's into space like my younger son.
MBD, you have been enjoying the smell of spring lilacs.
Yeah, so as everyone who listens to the podcast know, I want to become a green thumb. Unfortunately, I'm very far from that, and my lawn is infested with Poa trivialis because of the cool spring. But just on the weekend, my youngest son, I got him like a little Nerf dart gun thing, and we ended up just the two of us being outside together. It was kind of super humid and warm, and he was just having a blast shooting these Nerf darts at me. And a couple of lilac bushes in my yard and the neighbor's yard were really blooming and like making the air almost drunk with the smell of lilac. And it was just one of those moments where like eternity seems to break into the present, and I'll always remember my son now when I smell lilac.
Very nice. Very nice. It's a hard winter and a slow developing spring in the Northeast, but when it really blooms, it is glorious. Charlie Cook, speaking of glorious, you've been enjoying the Yankee season so far.
Well, I didn't for the first week. And now I really, really am. The Yankees are the best team in baseball. Hovering at around 750. They are doing more than just hitting home runs. The bullpen is good. They're capable of coming back once down, which is great after last year. And the few exceptions, last year, if the Yankees went down two or three runs in a game, it was over. This year, you just never, ever count them out. And when they lose, they tend to lose by a run. So it's been enormously enjoyable to sit and watch them this year. And while this isn't good for my sleep, it is nice to be able to keep watching until the ninth inning in the hope that the team will come back.
So as longtime listeners know, I'm kind of obsessive about sunlight. I just love this time of year. It'll be 8:40 or 8:45 now, and you'll still see a little light in the sky, which is wonderful. But We're just a month away from the summer solstice, June 21st, longest day of the year. And from there, this end of summer is almost upon us, and it begins to get darker and darker every single day. But this is a wonderful time of the year. With that, it's time for our editor's picks, MBD. What's your pick?
My pick is Kevin Williamson's The Buffalo Blame Game. He kind of addresses the very topic we were talking about earlier in the show. And it's just as good as everything else Kevin writes for the Tuesday, which you should subscribe to.
Jim Garrity, what's your pick?
Well, I was going to go with that one. My backup pick is it Mark Joffe?
Yeah, I think so.
No one's correcting me, so I'm assuming that's the correct pronunciation. Have we reached peak China? And, you know, many of us have been China skeptics or China critics for a very long time, but in large swaths of the country, particularly in the business community, but also in quite a few political leaders, have basically been China cheerleaders. You can, you know, probably most egregiously, the Thomas Friedman, "If only we could be like Beijing for a day" column from years back, and pointing to not only all the problems that they've had with COVID-19, but the continuing shutdowns of Shanghai and everything else. All of a sudden, that Chinese model doesn't look like such a sterling example and doesn't look like this phenomenal triumph that all of us in the West should emulate. So well written, well argued, and must reading.
Well done, Jim. I liked how you had the backup ready to go immediately. You could seamlessly transition to your second pick if your first was taken. Charlie Cook.
My pick is Kyle Smith, who has written a piece called "Biden Calls for More Cowbell." That's an SNL joke, Blue Oyster Cult. The point Kyle is making is that the explanation that the Biden team has come up with for their current predicament is wrong. It believes that it needs to have sharper elbows and sharper tongues when actually it needs to address what people actually care about. Kyle's view is that if Biden goes down this road, he will fail even harder because he will lose one of the one attributes that he has tried to cultivate, which is that he's nice old Uncle Joe.
So I'm also have a Kyle Smith pick. What they're not telling us about the Buffalo shooter, going through in detail some of what we discussed earlier about aspects of this manifesto that do not fit the convenient ideological narrative that the media is trying to shoehorn it into. So that's it for us. You've been listening to a Nashville podcast, and you rebroadcast, retransmission, or account of this game without the express or written permission of Nashville Magazine is strictly prohibited. This podcast has been produced by the incomparable Sarah Schutte, who makes it sound better than we deserve. Thank you, Charlie. Thank you, Jim. Thank you, MBD. Thanks to Allegiance Gold Outer and What Happens Next in 6 Minutes. And thanks especially to all of you for listening. We're the editors. We'll see you next time.